Welcome to Self-Compassionate Professor, a career wellness podcast for mid-career and recovering academics who want more. More meaning, balance, rest, joy, and more clarity. Our motto here is no regrets. So glad you're here.
Hello, hello. Welcome. This is Danielle Delamar, and you are listening to episode 130. So I will start by just kind of apologizing for my children. My house is really loud right now, and there's truly nothing I can do about it. I don't know if you know what I'm talking about, but that, like, can you be a little bit quieter? Like, when you're really in need of them being quiet because you need to, you know, record a podcast, for example, it seems like it makes them louder. I mean, I don't know if you have that experience, but that's been mine. So anyway, excuse the you know, tiny children voices in the background. And maybe they won't be so tiny. Maybe you'll get to hear a good scream or something. Anyway, it's so good to have you here. I am continuing with my choosing wellness theme for the month of August. And I have chosen one of my most favorite episodes of all time with Dr. Alyssa Ackerman, who... oh, when we talk about themes of wellness, she covers just about all of them. Like, you know, finding your authentic voice and doing it even though it feels really scary and it's sort of out of alignment with what you've been trained to do as an academic. Connecting to yourself, deepening that relationship with yourself, but also deepening the relationship you have with those around you by just showing up in a more authentic way. There's so many lessons in this interview, and Alyssa has so many fun updates to report. So since we recorded this, it released in January of 2021, although we recorded it in 2020, at the end of 2020. But since it was released, she has launched an organization, Ampersands Restorative Justice. Check it out. I will leave the link in the show notes. And in 2021 and 22, they, at that organization, have trained 22 new facilitators to take sexual harm cases, and they continue to facilitate cases and consult with organizations and do a host of other things related to restorative justice. Alyssa also says that her public speaking and her keynoting has picked up exponentially. Where she's been giving talks in Europe and Canada and all over the US. And she's doing that both live and via Zoom. So again, if this is a service that your institution needs, contact Alyssa. And then Alyssa has also continued to do the podcast she talks about in this interview. And she says she's almost done with the second season of the podcast, which she started during the pandemic. Not the second season, but her podcast she launched when the pandemic first started. It was one of those interesting things that came up because of the downtime that we all experienced in the early stages of the pandemic, right? She had this insight that a podcast would be a good idea. And lo and behold, it's been super successful. Anyway, if you have any doubts that you can do a side hustle, that you cannot do work beyond your regular academic work, listen to Alyssa, right? Like, she does stuff she wants to do, and she draws boundaries when she needs to in her regular academic job so that she can do the stuff she really, really feels called to do. again, another lesson in wellness. There is a very good reason I chose this particular interview for this August Choosing Wellness series. Anyway, enjoy the interview. It's so good. Here it is now.
Thank you so much for joining us today. I'm talking to Dr. Alyssa Ackerman, professor of criminal justice and co-creator of Beyond Fear, the Sex Crimes podcast. Alyssa, thank you so much for being here.
Yeah, I'm thrilled to be here talking to you today, Danielle.
Oh, I'm so happy to be talking to you too. And I had such a great conversation with you last month when we initially connected. And then between then and now, I've had the opportunity to see your TED Talk. And I've also had the opportunity to listen to some of your podcasts. And I actually chose the episode you told me you were most proud of. Mm-hmm. So what are the odds? I'm so happy. So I want to, I guess, start with that. You have said to me that the TED Talk is something that was the highlight of your career up until you started the podcast. And then that became sort of the highlight. And then you told me that this last episode that you created was the thing that you are most proud of in your life. Mm-hmm. And so let's unpack all of that. Tell me about that. Why? Because I'm thinking you're a professor. You've had a successful academic career. You know, there's the teaching, research, service piece. Yet all the stuff you've done outside of academia has been the highlight of your career.
Right. So I would start with the TED Talk. So when I did this TED Talk, it was really the most public thing that I had ever done, merging the personal and the professional, and talking about my professional work in a way where, you know, the stance that I take, so I'm a sex crimes policy researcher, and the stance that I take on policy is not a very popular stance, but it's based in the evidence, it's based in the research. So to get up there on the TEDx stage and talk about that and stand firm in that while also owning and talking about my experience as a survivor of sexual violence was incredibly powerful. And it took so much guts to get up there on that stage. My parents had never heard me talk before. They were sitting in the audience. And so it was really powerful. And it's been very, very well received. That was 2 years ago. And it really changed the direction of my career. I started doing a lot more public facing work outside of the university. And when the pandemic began, I was talking with a colleague, a dear friend of mine, and I said, I think we need to do a podcast. And she said, like, I was literally telling my husband that last night. And I was like, then it's done. We're starting a podcast. And within a week, we were up and running. So the podcast has been really well received. We have about 15,000 listeners. We were named in the top 100 Apple True Crime podcasts a couple of months ago. So, and again, it's on this topic about sex crimes and sex crimes policy and people who commit sex crimes that isn't really popular, but we're gaining a public audience that needs to hear this. And one of the things we've been really, really clear about the whole season was that we have to be open and transparent and vulnerable. And so from the first episode, we both talked about our experience as survivors. And, you know, through the podcast, we talked about what some of the consequences of being a survivor are. But in this last episode, we were very, very deliberate. And we talked about all of the stuff that we never talk about publicly. From medical care, accessing medical care, trauma-informed medicine, being traumatized by doctors, to mental illness. So I'm somebody who lives with bipolar disorder and navigating a mental illness and trauma and trying to figure out which is which, right? Is it the trauma today? Is it the mental illness today? Is it the anxiety today? And I feel like as an expert in my field, whether within the academy or publicly facing, especially publicly facing, when you have a platform, you have to use it for good. And so that's why I'm most proud of it, because it opened to an audience that needed to hear it, to know that you can be successful, you can do what you love, you can be creative, you can change the world and still struggle and be open about that. So it is the thing I am most proud of in my life.
Okay. So one of the things that gets me thinking about is this piece where you're talking about, you know, here we are in the pandemic, and I just had this idea that I needed to do a podcast. And then you talk to Alexa, right? It's Alexa?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Yes, your co-host. Mm-hmm. And Alexa's like, yes, I had the same thought. Mm-hmm. Let's do it. Okay, so this is a little piece I want to talk about just because people who I'm talking to often are like stuck in the hamster wheel of academia and just trying to get stuff done and doing the thing. And like they've lost their creativity and they've lost their sense of self and they're not grounded. And very often when they get to this place where they're sort of in a sabbatical mindset, good things happen. Like they have these creative insights. And it feels to me that that's what happened to you. You tell me where I'm wrong, but like the pandemic, everything sort of stopped. And then you had this creative insight. And so I'm wondering, is that true? Is that what happened? Or did it emerge differently?
So I would say yes, and differently. So, you know, the institution that I'm at, I've been here, this is my fourth year here. I was a tenured professor at the University of Washington, Tacoma, before I switched institutions and gave up my sabbatical year when we moved. So I had gone, you know, 15 years as an academic without a semester off. And so I felt like I lost that creative time and was just looking forward to it. And next year would have been the year that I could have applied for a sabbatical here. So that was absolutely part of my thinking. Like I had time away and time on my hands to get creative. But I had been thinking about creative ways to use my work in the public sphere for a long time. It just happened that because we were going to be locked in our homes for as long as we were, and you know, my closet is usually where I record the podcast from, was a place that I would escape to because it was the only quiet place in the house. The podcast seemed like the right direction to go. And Alexa agreed wholeheartedly. So yes, it was absolutely part, you know, thinking along the lines of sabbatical, but at the same time, it wasn't sabbatical because we're still teaching online. We still have a full course load. We still have all the admin work. We just had that extra time. And I kind of made the decision that I wasn't going to be publishing peer-reviewed articles anymore. I've done that. And it wasn't making the change in the world that I wanted to make. Because everyday people don't read them, don't have access to them. It's all behind paywalls, right? So it wasn't making the change on the individual or societal level that I wanted to see. And I thought that a podcast might do that.
Okay. So is that the whole reason in your mind? I want to like go all the way back to like why the PhD? Like, sure. Have you always wanted to do the public connection, sending healing messages, but you know what I mean, connecting in meaningful ways that help people to heal? Like, why was it that you started with the PhD to begin with?
That's a great question. So no, I had no intention of ever getting a PhD. I don't know how I even graduated college. I failed out of college my first semester because of the trauma of my rape, and nobody checked in. Nobody asked if I was okay. And I just kind of floundered. So I ended up getting an associate's degree in business marketing and management and thought, what am I ever going to do with this? I hate this. And when I applied back to Florida State University, I had originally gone to college as a biology major. I wanted to be a medical doctor. And the biology program wouldn't let me in because I had failed all the prereqs. So I thought, hey, criminal justice sounds easy. It's not easy, but it changed my life. And from there, sort of worked in the juvenile justice system for a little while and realized, you know, if we want to make change, it doesn't happen from within the system. We have to make the change outside of the system. So I went on to a master's degree. And in that master's program, took a class on sex crimes. And, you know, the first day of class, I'm thinking, why am I even doing this? This is the worst decision I could possibly make, but it ended up being the best one I could make because the professor from that class then said, you should really apply to the PhD program, and was my dissertation advisor through the PhD. And I realized somewhere in that time that any thought that I had about working with survivors wouldn't actually end victimization, right? Like, that's why I wanted to go into court. I want to end sex crimes. I don't want them to happen. But if you're working with people who have already experienced it, you're not preventing it. And that's why I started working with people who have sexually offended and working on sex crimes policy. And so the whole first half of my career was focused on sex crimes policy and practice. What are we doing? What works? How do we know if it's effective or not? And, you know, about 6 or 7 years of that work showed me that what we are doing is totally ineffective. There's not been a single study that has ever shown that it is effective. We're doing it all wrong.
Wow.
But I had done all of this work silent about the fact that I was a survivor because I didn't want people to think that I wasn't objective, that somehow my personal story was impacting my ability to do sound research. And I've had other academics call me out for that and say, like, you can't make decisions about students who are survivors because you're too close to it, because you're a survivor, that kind of stuff, which is why I never wanted to be public. And it was a colleague of mine who said, you have an important story to tell. And if people aren't going to take your work objectively, that's their problem. It's not yours. And so about 6 years ago, I went public as a survivor, which is a big deal in a field of sex crimes experts, because very few of us are public about that. And so that was 2014. And then, you know, 2018 was the TED Talk, and 2014 was the first shift of the career. The TED Talk was then sort of the big shift. And here I am. So no, I never intended to do this work.
Okay. So what I guess I'm really interested in is, what about that class in your master's program got you to the point where you're like, yeah, yep, I should totally go on for the PhD. You know, you're talking to this professor who eventually becomes your advisor. What was pulling you there? And is the pull something different as you look back at it now than it was then? I'm just curious if you have anything around that.
I love that question. So I would say two things. One, it was the first time in my life that I learned that my experiences in the aftermath of sexual violence were typical, were normal, that I was not alone. And that was really empowering. Mm. And the other part of it was, you know, I had all of this anger and hatred towards the man who assaulted me and believed, like, you know, people who behave this way, they should be locked up. We should throw away the key. They should never be let out. And listening to this professor and reading her book and reading other studies made me shift my perspective completely in the span of 15 weeks. And that's actually not what we should do, that it doesn't stop people from reoffending. It doesn't teach them anything. And it certainly doesn't help survivors because that's not what we actually want at the end of the day. And so that shift in perspective is what has driven me all of these years, because I see the public facing work changing lives and keeping people from reoffending. And I would say it is still what drives me, because I teach a very similar class. And, you know, the podcast is basically the public facing class. And I see other people shift their perspective as well. And to be the conduit for those changing perspectives is something I'm really proud of.
So it's always been about sort of self-healing and healing others.
Yes.
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 Okay. And so then talk about how you felt in that class in your master's program
in terms of a connection to self? Did you feel a deeper connection to self? And what did that look like? And if that was too long ago, and that's fine. If it's a bad question, that's fine.
No, I'm thinking back to it. We were living in New York City at the time, and we lived in Brooklyn, and you know, the school that I went to was in Manhattan. So I always had long subway rides and long walks home from the subway to really process. I think it was that class that helped me define my sense of self for the first time. You know, one of the things I say in the TED Talk and, you know, continue to say all the time is that there is the before rape, or there's the before trauma, and there's the after trauma. And in many ways, they remain disconnected. And I feel like, so my rape happened in 1999. This class was 2005. Between those years, I don't think I knew who I was. I think that I lost that in the assault. And for the first time, this professor, her name is Dr. Karen Terry, she saw me in a way that I couldn't see myself. And she believed in me in a way that I couldn't believe in myself. And she pushed me. And so for the first time, I felt validated as a human being. I felt like my experiences mattered, though I didn't tell her about my assault until 2014. She still saw me. She wasn't surprised at all when I disclosed to her. But she saw me. And that really helped me gain the sense of who I am. And from that point forward, like, I have seen myself as the sex crimes expert, the professional survivor now, right? So that class was everything.
Okay, so you finally are grounding yourself. You're finally having this sense of self. You go on to the PhD. You have this first half of your career where it's all about sex crimes policy, and you're silent about who you are as a survivor. Mm-hmm. And then you said in 2014, you go personal. Mm-hmm. How did that happen? It's like these three different stages of mm-hmm. evolving and healing that I'm seeing.
Yeah. So I was writing a textbook, and it was an introduction to criminal justice textbook using personal narrative to teach the material. Again, if we go back to that connection piece, like, just reading dry material in a textbook, we didn't want to do it in school, and our students certainly don't want to do it. So I came up with this idea to get stories from people who were incarcerated, people who had committed crimes, people who are public defenders and prosecuting attorneys, and like all of these really rich stories to teach the content for an intro to criminal justice class. And as I was writing the book, it dawned on me that I am a hypocrite, that I am asking all of these people to share these really deeply personal experiences, and I'm not willing to do it myself. So I sat down and I wrote a 2,000 word narrative about the experience of my assault and how that shifted my career. And it was both a blessing and a curse. It is in the textbook, but it sent me spiraling into PTSD in a way that I didn't expect, because I hadn't talked about it. I hadn't written about it. I hadn't gone to therapy for it. I just had kind of stuffed it, because here I was, the sex crimes expert, and I was fine, as I was telling myself. And I had two very young children. I had a 2-year-old and a 4-year-old. I had not disclosed to my wife, who I've been with since 2002, and she noticed the change. She said, "What is wrong with you? What is going on?" And at that point I told her, and she's like, "You need to go to therapy. Like, this is not healthy." So it was a curse in that it brought back all of the trauma. It was a blessing because I was finally able to work through it and to own it and to publicly talk about it, which allows others to do the same.
And so what did that look like to get to a place where you could finally talk about it publicly?
It's, I don't even have words for it. I'm a different person because of it. And you'll see, you know, friends of mine will laugh that, you know, pre-2014, the way that I dressed, the way that I looked, even my facial expressions, were different because I was hiding. And that wall is gone. And I get to be fully me. I'm not ashamed of any of this. It wasn't my fault. And if I can use those experiences to help others, then all of it was worth it. So you see that now. I'm fully me in a way that I didn't know that I could be. Yeah. And it was actually a dear friend of mine who gave a sermon about living with bipolar disorder. And it was before I had my diagnosis, and it had nothing to do with my, you know, my academic work or, you know, my personal life at the time. But I was sitting there when she was giving the sermon, and before she started, she looked directly at me and shook her head yes, and then started speaking about this, you know, this lifetime of experience with bipolar disorder. And I'm like, why is she looking at me? And my best friend was sitting next to me and said, that's going to be you someday. And I was like, no, like within 6 months, I was given my first public talk as a survivor. And I thought that's what they meant. And it wasn't until, you know, 2 years ago when I got my diagnosis of bipolar disorder that it made sense why my friend looked at me, because she saw it in me when I couldn't see it in myself. And that's so it kind of comes full circle. If I can be open about being a survivor and I can be open about the PTSD and the anxiety, then I need to be open about the mental health stuff too.
So this TED talk that you gave 4 years later was like the ultimate in sort of coming out of, as a survivor, but then this recent episode that you just recorded, right, on your podcast was this coming out as somebody who has dealt with mental health stuff. And so it's like, the more public you get, the more fully you become yourself. Is that what I'm hearing?
Yeah, I would say the more open I get. I mean, I happen to be a public figure in my field, but the more open I am, the more fully myself I become.
Is there anything that you can remember pre-2014 about the, I don't know, is there a particular story or just a particular thing that happened to you, a moment that really felt like you were hiding and you weren't fully yourself? I'm just asking so that we can get a clear idea of what it feels like to be in hiding, because so many of us are in hiding and not knowing it.
Particular moment. Yeah. So it was 2007. I think it was 2007. So I was on the doctoral student council for the entire graduate center of the City University of New York. And I disclosed for the first time to somebody else who was on the doctoral student council. We were doing office hours together, and I don't know what came over me, but it was just like, you're hiding and you're a hypocrite. And I just blurted it out. And this person looked at me, she goes, oh, so we're those kinds of friends now, are we? And I didn't expect it. I don't know what came over me. And then I never said anything again. And so from 2007 to 2014, it ate me up inside. I remember then in 2011, the friend that I finally disclosed to, who was like, this is an important story to tell, I tried to tell her in 2011. We were driving in her car up the highway in South Florida, where I'm from, coming home from a conference. And I was staring out the window thinking, how am I going to tell her that I'm a survivor? I can never tell her, but I want to tell her. And it took me another 3 years. All of those years, like, I knew that I was living in silence. And the funny thing is that when I finally started telling people, they were like, we knew that. My wife said to me, you can't live with a trauma survivor for 12 years and not know it. You're not fooling anybody.
What does living in silence feel like? Like, if you had a metaphor for it, what does it feel like?
A slow, painful death of yourself.
I mean, it's so interesting that we're talking about this, because, like, I mean... as somebody who was an academic who wanted so badly to
to perform well and show everyone that I was good enough and all the stuff. And I overworked to make sure I did that. I always did things that were never in sort of my own interest. I never went for things that I found creative or interesting. I always went for the things that would make me look good to everybody else. And that was connected to a different kind of trauma when I was younger. But I really associate this with the way my career played out. It's this living in silence, like you said, this slow, painful death. Mm-hmm. And it's not until you sort of like turn into it and confront it that you can start to sort of come out and be more open and feel more comfortable in your own skin. Mm-hmm. I don't know why I'm saying all of this, but I guess I'm just connecting to your story in my own way. And I wonder if you have anything more to say around that.
I think you are 100% spot on. I think any of us, like, I mean, trauma comes in many forms and none of us get out of here unscathed. But when you've experienced trauma as a young person, one of the things that you lose is your sense of self, your ability to stand up for yourself, your ability to set proper boundaries, your ability to say no. And so I find that also in my own career, the only thing that I ever said yes to, people said early on, do not specialize in sex crimes, you'll never get a job. And I was like, I don't care. Like I have to do this for me, right? I'm trained as a generalist, but my expertise is sex crimes and I'm not gonna deny that. But other than that, I've never known how to say, no, I don't want to be on that committee. I don't want to do this task that you're asking me to do. So I take it all on. And, you know, it doesn't matter what department you're in or what kind of department you're in. There are those who take on all of the work and do all of the service. And there's those who do none of it. And you become resentful. And I'm one of those people who took on everything because I didn't know how to say no. I didn't know how to take care of myself. Becoming public about these things in my life taught me very quickly how to say no, how to protect myself, how to practice self-care, and to not be apologetic about it.
Okay, so how are you doing that? I mean, right now we're in the middle of a pandemic. I just talked to somebody who is teaching a 4-4 load, who is just sinking, who, you know, has had a hell of a time in so many ways, as so many of us have. How are you doing all that you're doing as a professor who is also doing a podcast and taking care of kids and all the other stuff? How are you taking care of yourself now that you've learned how to do that?
So the first thing that I learned, the first thing that I had to learn to do this is that my academic job is my job. It is not my life. Mm-hmm. And up until maybe the last 2 years or so, my academic job was my life. Like I'd be writing on Saturday mornings and staying up late to grade papers. And now I don't. Like my job is 9 to 5. Right. I teach my classes. I do the service work that is required of me. But I've really shifted like that research piece. I'm doing things that bring me joy, that allow me to be creative. And by setting those work boundaries and say, like, this is my job, has allowed me to then focus my time on my children, on my wife, on self-care, in ways that I never did before. So I love being with students. I love teaching them. I love seeing the wheels spin. I love those aha moments. So that drives me in my day job. And then the creative work that I get to do with people who I love and respect. Like all of the guests on the podcast are people who are dear friends of mine. We just happen to do the same kind of work. Mm-hmm. So having those connections has been really helpful doing this through a pandemic. But if I didn't have the work that was filling my soul. And that's all the work I'm doing outside of my day job. I don't know how I would be able to continue doing the work as a professor, but those boundaries, like I needed those boundaries.
Okay. So what do you say to people who are in the rat race and feeling like, you know, my academic job has always been everything. And, you know, everybody around me, right, culturally, the institution, your professional organization, all the academic pieces, all the academic players are telling you, no, this is a lifestyle. This is a calling. This is not a job. And so you are feeling like you got to do all the stuff. Mm-hmm. And you are bending and bending and bending, and you are close to breaking, and you want out, and you want a sense of space, and you want to feel the joy that you're talking about and the creativity, and you want to take care of yourself, but you just simply can't figure out how to do it, because there's right now the story you're hearing over and over again and have been hearing since grad school is that there's no time for that. So what do you tell people? What is sort of your advice to those of us who are in that space?
That's a good question. I would say first, get real still, get real quiet with yourself and figure out what it is that you want, right? I think that there are people who believe that academia is a lifestyle. I lived it for a long time, but at the end of the day, like if I thought about the goals I wanted to accomplish with my expertise, it wasn't to write that next journal article, right? Like it was to change lives. And there's some academic research that does, but for me, it's not happening, right? I've published. Nobody reads it. Except other academics with similar interests. That doesn't change people's lives. So I had to get really quiet with myself. What is it that I want to accomplish? And how can I go about accomplishing it? So this is what I tell people, right? What is it that you want to do? And if your goals are incongruent with the space that you find yourself in, the only person who can make a change is you, because your institution sure isn't going to do it.
Yeah.
Right? Institutions work because of the rat race we find ourselves in. Mm-hmm. I had a cousin of mine text me the other night and said, I want to get a PhD. How long did it take you to get your PhD? I want to be like you. And I said, well, why do you want a PhD? And they said, well, I want to teach. I want to consult. I want to write a book. And I want to make a lot of money. And I said, then do not, under any circumstances, get a PhD. Like, why would you do that? Because I think there's this belief that you get that PhD, you're an expert, you're highly esteemed in your field, you make a lot of money. Like, that's not how it works. That comes from the consulting work you do outside of the institution. Mm-hmm. And that's where lives change.
Mm-hmm. Okay. So while we're on this, I have completely forgotten to ask you about the consulting work you're doing.
So when I came out publicly as a survivor, one of the things that happened was the friend that I first disclosed to, she's also a treatment provider for men who have sexually offended. And I was home visiting my parents one spring break, I think. And she asked me if I would come talk to the men in her group. But she wanted me to come as Alyssa, the rape survivor, not Dr. Ackerman, the sex crimes expert. And I went. I was terrified, but I went. And spent 3 hours that night talking to a total of about 30 men. And it was life-changing. And after that, we had a conversation about what exactly it was that we were doing. And what we were doing is called restorative justice. I've taught about it my whole career, but I didn't realize in the moment what we were doing. And so the consulting work that I do has built on what we did that first night. We've written a book about it. We've, you know, I've continued that work with her and with other treatment providers. And along the way, became a restorative justice facilitator. I'm one of the only people, there's very, very few of us, probably I can count on one hand, maybe two, of the number of people in the United States who are restorative justice facilitators who will take sex crimes cases. And so my consulting work on the side is both people who have experienced sexual harm and people who have perpetrated it, who reach out to me and ask me to facilitate restorative justice sessions for them. And so I spend a lot of my time facilitating those kinds of cases. I do, you know, consulting work around building restorative justice programs and policies and trainings on restorative justice, public talks on restorative justice, specifically in sex crimes cases. So it's very niche, but it's very needed.
And what is it about that work? Because there's a lot of things you're doing in that work. So what is it about that work that you most enjoy?
I really love the prevention side of it and the accountability piece. So watching people who have caused harm own their behavior, you know, for somebody to come forward and say, yes, I committed this rape against you. I am so incredibly sorry. And sorry to me, in my work, is not a passive thing. It's an active thing. So watching these individuals continue to do accountability work, years and years and years worth of accountability work to help the person that they harmed or to help other people who have been harmed to heal is incredibly rewarding. And watching people who have been harmed find healing and closure that they have not been able to find, you know, myself included. I mean, trauma therapy was incredible for me and was very, very healing, but it was restorative justice work that helped me find closure in a way that therapy didn't. And I've heard many, many survivors say the same thing. And that has been so rewarding.
Okay. So I guess I want to just ask, what is it about the restorative justice work that, I don't know, goes a little bit deeper in your healing versus the therapy?
Yeah. So for me personally, I don't know the man who raped me. It was a guy I met at a party 20 minutes before it happened. So I will never have the opportunity to hear him acknowledge the harm that he caused in my life. And I can talk about that till I'm blue in the face with my therapist, and I have. But hearing men who have committed very similar offenses look me in the eye and tell me that my presence there, hearing me talk about my experience, has changed them and has changed the way they think about their own behavior. And that prior to me coming, they had never considered the harm that they caused. And that this was not my fault was really powerful. That was closure. I always thought about the guy who raped me as a monster, but sitting with other men who had committed similar offenses made me realize that he was just a human. He did a monstrous thing, but he was just a human. So that brought closure for me. And I see that in the clients that I work with, especially when they are sitting with the person who harmed them. Right. So trauma survivors often say, and not all of them, right? I can't speak for all trauma survivors, but a lot of them will say, I need acknowledgement that I was harmed. I need accountability. I need somebody to say, I did this. I need answers. Why me? Like, why did this happen? And I need an apology. Hmm. And the criminal justice process does not allow for that. But the restorative justice response does.
What are you doing? Because I'm hearing this kind of deep work that you're doing in this space. And the vulnerability and, again, that deep work you're doing in your podcast space, how is that different from the work you do in your classroom? I'm just curious because I'm thinking about the textbook you've written using personal accounts. And so what does that look like now, and how much does teaching feed you at the moment?
Yeah, also a great question. So post 2014, my teaching doesn't look much different than my public facing work. Because I teach from a very restorative perspective. I'm very, very close with my students. I don't hide from them. I talk about mental illness. I talk about sexual assault. I talk about all of this stuff because it pertains to their lives too. So I find that work to be incredibly rewarding. And so the conversations that I have with my students during office hours are often very, very deep conversations. Because when you honor somebody's humanity and you give them a safe space, they're willing to open up about things that they may not have otherwise been willing to talk about. So my students absolutely feed my soul. Being in the middle of a pandemic online all the time makes that harder. And if all I had to do in my academic job was work with students, I would never stop doing that because they are incredible. They're incredible. Mm. But prior to 2004, I was very, very closed off. Like I never would have talked about any of this stuff. So I wasn't as effective as a professor, as a teacher. And my public facing work, I still see myself as a teacher, right? Like I'm being able to connect with people and to change their opinions on things simply by living my life openly teaches mm-hmm. people a new perspective. And I don't have to flaunt I'm Dr. Ackerman. Nobody cares, right? Like it's the personal piece. It's the connecting on a soul level that changes people. You know, and even in the classroom, like, you know, I was teaching research methods this semester and my students were really struggling, and I revamped the syllabus. Like, we're going to cut out a ton of this material. It's not important in the grand scheme of your life. What is important is your mental health and your connection to others and your lack of isolation, right? If we can offer grace and compassion and connection to our students, that is a service to them. And whether there are students in an institution or students in the general public, right? The number of people I have connected with over this episode of the podcast, over my TED talk, right? It's been incredible. And it's because of the personal stuff. It's not because I can spout off statistics on sex crimes. Nobody cares.
You seem to be looking for joy and creativity much more diligently or with much more interest than you did before. And I'm wondering what that connection is.
I will answer this with a story. So
yes.
Several years ago, I was living in Washington State and I had this amazing trauma therapist. And every week she'd come out to get me in the waiting room and I was coloring in one of those adult coloring books. And she looked at me one day and got this smirk on her face and said, "Alyssa, do you ever do anything outside the lines?" And I was like, "No, like, why would I ever do anything outside the lines? I'm a researcher. Like everything is supposed to be perfect." And she said, "Well, I challenge you to do something outside the lines." And I was like, "What are you talking about?" And she said, "I challenge you." I said, "I don't even know what that means." Well, after that session, I went to an art store and I purchased some watercolor paint and some paintbrushes and started painting. I had no idea that I was an artist. No idea, because I was trained so much to be a researcher, right? You don't do things outside the lines. And so I really honed that skill. And within 6 months, I was doing art shows, selling my painting, selling my art. And what I realized through that for myself and for others is that all of us are struggling. All of us have something that we don't talk about, that keeps us up at night. None of us get out of here unscathed. And if we can bring a little bit of light to the world, that we can make a huge difference. And so whether that is the public-facing creative work that I'm doing with the podcast or doing artwork, like through the pandemic, I've been doing chalk art in front of my house so that people in the neighborhood, when they're out walking their dogs, can come by and get a little bit of joy. Mm-hmm. And so seeing joy in others creates joy in me. Mm-hmm. And so if we all just pay it forward a little bit with that, with joy and creativity, we are changing the world, right? The world can be a beautiful place if we look for the helpers, if we look for the creativity, if we look for the joy. And that's especially important right now when all we're seeing is, you know, 15 million people in this country have this virus, 3,000 died yesterday, right? It's been hell.
Yeah.
So I'm trying to find ways. You're absolutely correct. I am trying to find ways, both because of my experiences and in spite of them, to find that joy, to kindle that light just a little bit for other people.
Thanks for listening to Self-Compassionate Professor. Find me on LinkedIn at Danielle Delamar, on Twitter and Instagram at Danielle SC Prof, or schedule a free coaching consult at selfcompassionateprofessor.com. Be well.